Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 2014, Ohio lawmakers designated the last week in September as American Indian Week. Coming up, we'll hear about efforts to reconnect with tribes that were forced to leave Ohio generations ago. Right now, we're going to talk about language. Shared language is part of what cements any culture and community for many American Indian tribes, but many of those languages have fallen from use. That was the case for the language of the Miamia tribe. Daryl Baldwin at Miami University has worked to reverse the losses. Thus, last week, it was announced that Baldwin is among 23 people to receive so-called genius grants from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Daryl Baldwin joins us now by phone from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, where he is director of the Miamia Center. Congratulations on the OIA award, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann.
So, I mean, I can tell people, it's important to, the importance of language, but can you tell us why it's important to revitalize a language in this way?
Well, I think for many indigenous communities, our languages are very, very key to our identities. They also encode within them our indigenous knowledge system. It's through our language that we express ourselves, at least in our case as Miamia people. And so language is very, very important to maintaining the diversity or the ethnic specificity of our people.
When I studied Spanish years ago, it was the first time I realized that there were words in another language that were not comparable to the English language. And I'm wondering, to what extent as a linguist is that true for American Indian languages?
Well, I think that's probably characteristic to many languages. Different cultures kind of reorient themselves in their life experiences. And of course, the languages reflect that. So, for instance, we have a departing term, Nepal-Palo. And it often gets translated as to take care. But the stem of that particular term is tied to notions of wisdom, learning, and also being conscious. And so what's embodied in that is this idea that as human beings, our awareness and our seeking of knowledge is really what's central. And at least for our culture, that is taking care. That's taking care of oneself and asking one to be careful.
How did you learn the language?
Well, the Miamia language ceased to be spoken in the middle 20th century, about the time I was born, actually. And I began personal quest to learn what I could about the language and to see what was documented. Sometime in the early 1990s, I bumped into a young scholar by the name of David Costa, who was at the University of California, Berkeley, and he too was looking to see what was known on the Miamia language, also known as the Miami language.
Mm-hmm.
And that led him to archives around the country, and what he uncovered was nearly 270 years of written documentation on the Miamia language. Through much of his work, then I focused mainly on the family. My wife and I were committed to homeschooling our kids and attempting to revitalize the language in the home. And that became a lifelong effort that's led us all the way up into the present. So using Dr. Costa's work, and then also our passion for wanting to revitalize the language, a reconstructed language, we've worked together over the years.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about language and how it cements culture and community for many American Indian tribes. My guest is Daryl Baldwin. He's cultural preservationist and the director of the Miamia Center at Miami University of Ohio. He's also one of 23 recently announced to receive the so-called genius grants from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Was it hard to learn the language by way of, research versus having someone teach it to you?
Yes, absolutely. Obviously the most efficient way and the direct way to learn a language and natural way to learn a language is from speakers and to be immersed in a speaking environment. And that's not certainly the easiest part. I think for our effort And because of the heavy research and reconstruction portion of this, which, by the way, is still ongoing, that adds a whole new element. That just, what it does is it just increases the time by which language slowly begins to reemerge. And so the way to really think about an effort like this is that it's intergenerational. So even out of that 270 years worth of documentation, we have only utilized a portion of it. So we're still transcribing, translating, coming across new terms that can then be incorporated into our educational efforts. So again, it's definitely going to be an intergenerational effort.
Could you speak, you said one word earlier, but could you speak a bit of the language so our listeners can get a sense of what it sounds like?
Isia, kinwala nisio wains wahana nila miyami ametosenia. Nishinele kochimiyane jayane uahanumbi kakikwe. Kelulilane. My name is Daryl. I'm a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. Certainly glad to be here, and thank you for asking me to speak to you today.
It's a beautiful language.
Yes, it's one of about 25 languages that fall in the Algonquian language family. And the Algonquian language family pretty much covers the Great Lakes region all the way over to the East Coast and up into Canada. So it's definitely the language of this land of Ohio and Indiana, Illinois.
So would you talk about what the Miamia Center does in terms of research and education? Do you have students that are taking classes in this language, for instance?
Yeah, it might be worth backing up a little bit. The Miami Tribe of Oklahoma and Miami University began to develop a relationship back in the 1970s by the leadership visited campus. That relationship slowly matured over time. In 1991, Miami University began offering what's called a Miami Indian Heritage Award, and that award was an attempt to offer educational opportunities for citizens of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, you know, mainly younger students. And we had three students come in 1999. The Miami Tribe students' numbers were fairly small for, I think, probably most of the 90s. The Miami Tribe then began to engage in language revitalization about the mid-1990s. So for several years, we attempted to build various programs at the community level. We attempted to carry forward the research or support the research of David Costa. And at some point, we just realized that a small tribe in Northeast Oklahoma, we just really didn't have the resources to affect that. And it was at that time that tribal leadership turned to their friends at Miami University and asked if they could help. And, of course, it was just an idea then, and this would have been the summer of 2000. And they got their heads together, and they decided that they would build a small project that would attempt to help the tribe with continued language development. I was asked to be the founding director. It was then called the Miamia Project, and so my family and I then moved near Oxford, Ohio, to continue that work. Over the years, everything has just grown tremendously. It just really wound up to be one of the best moves I think we ever made. The context of the relationship between tribe and university has been very supportive and nurturing, and I think it has just allowed both the university and the tribe to grow around this effort. Today, we have 34 tribe students at Miami University. And in 2013, what was then called the Miamia Project transitioned to the Miamia Center, and today we have seven staff, and we do a wide range of educational development and also research.
Right. When you started there as director, it was director of yourself, right?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Exactly right.
So what sort of things do you do when it comes to education? What are these 33 type students? Are they just getting an education, or is it, you know, get to go to Miami, or what?
Well, the tribe students that come to Miami are like most any other student. Yeah. There's a wide range of interest, so they're engaged in a lot of interdisciplinary courses. What's tied to their Heritage Award is that they're required to take a series of courses that we teach through the Miamia Center that specifically pertain to language, culture, ecological perspectives, history, and then also modern issues like tribal sovereignty and self-determination. And the intent is that that gives them a real broad snapshot of their tribal community. And with embedded within all of that is language. So again, language is something that can be used in most any environment. Some of those students have come up through our youth programs over the years. So in some cases, we've been working with them since they were 10 or 11 years old when they entered the what's called the A1 Zapata program, which is run out of Miami, Oklahoma. And so it's really a unique opportunity for us as tribal educators to be part of their educational experience over many, many years.
You know, when I moved to Ohio from Michigan, it was startling. It wasn't such a big deal in Michigan. There were American Indians, you know, all over the place, and it was a very common theme growing up there, but not so much Ohio. There was a huge breaking point, and they kind of wiped out everything from Ohio, it felt like. And now you're rebuilding that. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, we've long referred to Ohio, Illinois, and Indiana as the donut hole. And what we mean by that is that there are indigenous people, of course, that live in those states, but there are no tribes because in the 1800s, the tribes were forcibly relocated west and eventually down to Indian Territory, at least some of them. And it left a vacuum. And in that vacuum, a lot of the residents of those states just are not used to bumping into, you know, tribal sovereignty as it exists today.
And so what would you like to see happen in Ohio to change that? I know that's kind of the larger theme of the program today. What would you like to see?
Well, you know, I was born and raised in Northwest Ohio, so I came out of the public educational system. And, you know, the topic of Native Americans was primarily fixed in history class. And I think one of the detriments of that is that we're taught as a people of the past, not a living people with a past. And what that does is it kind of crystallizes us in history to where we're not allowed to evolve and change like every other nation of the world. And I think that's unfortunate. People tend to have a view of our history and our culture and our language as archaic things. And what we are teaching, and certainly what our own tribal students are learning, is that our culture and our language is very applicable today and has a purpose and very nurturing and in some cases healing for us because of our recent past.
News of the MacArthur Fellowship is still fresh, of course, but any sense now? Is something starting to take shape and how you might use it in your efforts going forward?
Well, as you can imagine, I get that question a lot.
Yeah, I know. And I've read, and so far, every time I've read about how you've responded, there hasn't been much of a response.
Well, it's just a surreal experience.
Yeah.
I mean, you just don't see something like that coming. And then when it does, it just really kind of forces you to stop and think, I guess, might be the way to look at it. But, you know, our effort is very well advanced. So it's not that there's going to be a major shift in our direction. It's not that there's a brand new program that needs to be created. But I think what can happen over time is that we can do what we're doing better. And so what we're going to be looking to do is, increasing some of the initiatives that we have, maybe reaching out to more tribal members. Many of our tribal members don't live in Oklahoma area, so outreach is a big challenge for us. And of course, technological developments are allowing us to do things that we couldn't do 10, 15 years ago. So I think there's lots of places that we're going to be able to enhance for this effort.
Darryl Baldwin, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Darryl Baldwin, he's a cultural preservationist and director of the Miamia Center at Miami University of Ohio. Also among 23 people last week to receive the Genius Grant from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. More coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In 2014, Ohio designated the last week in September as American Indian Week. Ohio is well-known home to earthworks and artifacts that help tell the history of American Indian tribes from this region. But the tribes themselves were forcibly removed from Ohio generations ago. Many eventually settled in Oklahoma. The Ohio History Connection and other organizations have worked to reestablish the ties of Indian nations to their ancestral homelands. Joining us now is President of the Delaware Nation of Oklahoma, Carrie Holton. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also with us is the Interim Director of the Newark's Earthwork Center at The Ohio State University, Marty Chatsmith. She is a citizen of the Comanche Nation of Oklahoma and a descendant of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
For more information about the events celebrating American Indian Week, visit the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Carrie, you were not raised in Oklahoma. Can you talk a bit about your upbringing and how you made the connection to your heritage growing up?
Certainly. I lived in Marietta, Georgia most of my life. The connection with my own tribe in Oklahoma was difficult at that time in the early days before internet, which is one of the reasons that kind of drove me to learn more and connect more because of that lack of information. I studied as much as I could, but the information just wasn't available in your.
How did you know about the connection?
Mother, yes, my mother raised me, telling me the story. She lived and grew up in Oklahoma, and was connected. And so I most of that was learning through my mother.
Mm-hmm. You know, so much of this happened so long ago, and now it's so much of the connections that are being made are because of technology connecting people. You know, right, Marty? I mean, that has to make a big difference for you as a scholar.
It makes a big difference. It makes Indian country much smaller. We can meet scholars that we read about on one day and connect them with them in an email the next. And with our tribal partners in Oklahoma, it's very easy to connect with them on email or phone or go visit with them. So
the connection with Oklahoma is a big one for Ohio. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, first I'd like to say that this is the land of the ancestors of our ancestors as Indian people, and to give respect to the tribes who were here, the Miami, the Shawnee, the Wyandot, the Anishinaabeg, and the Six Nations tribes, they were all here pre-contact, and they're coming back now. And Ohio is Indian land, so we think of it as a dichotomy between Oklahoma and Ohio,
right.
But really there's a continuity that's been happening ever since before removal. The riverways were the superhighways of the ancient times and historic times. And so people could go from northern above Canada all the way down to the Gulf Coast. So they were very connected to each other. And all of these, the context has always been the traditional knowledge as it accumulates and is used for technology and understanding astronomy and things like that. And the sacred ways and the sacred places. So land itself was sacred. That didn't change when people went from Ohio to Oklahoma. The interim, though, was a really tough, tough experience because so many lives were lost and so much was lost when they had to just pick up and leave. So
when you say that, I don't want to interrupt you, but,
sure.
But when you say that didn't change, meaning that even though people were forced out of Ohio and into Oklahoma, they still regarded the land of Ohio as sacred.
They did.
They never forgot it.
They never forgot that. And then that cultural view carried over to where they ended up in Oklahoma. So they were using that new space to claim it as their own, and so successfully that it was 150 years before people started coming back in formal ways.
And they have.
And they have been.
How does that manifest? I mean, they just come back here and move here, or are they coming back to study? What are they looking for? Just to be?
Well, actually, I don't know how much individual members of tribes or tribes themselves came here. I think there were some tribes like the Wyandot who came up here and developed relationships with city groups like Dublin and the Wyandot Nation have an arrangement, a partnership where they bring interns from the Wyandot Nation up here to work in the Dublin city offices. But it happened little by little, and it didn't really start right after removal. Mm-hmm. I mean, removal was like this glacier, and it destroyed memories and right. cultural ways, and so they had to like get their footing in Oklahoma. And some of the tribes didn't move once. I don't know Delaware's history, but they moved several times when they ended up in Oklahoma. Chief Glenna likes to say, of the Eastern Shawnee tribe likes to say they didn't have GPS.
Right.
So they That's would true. End up quite a ways from where they were supposed to be. But the homeland lost a lot about their homeland. And so their focus was survival in Oklahoma. So now people are coming up for various reasons. And one of the biggest is the World Heritage nomination of the ancient earthworks. And that leads to, and of course, they were always interested in their historic sites. Chillicothe, for example, there were many Chillicothes, but there were places of great significance to the tribes. So, for example, the Eastern Shawnee tribe has historical markers here. And I think other tribes are, you know, doing other kinds of things to establish and reestablish relationships with their places here and their histories.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Ohio's relationship to the rest of the world of American Indians. It's a very strong one. It's a homeland for many of them. But it's not regarded that way if you grew up here in the last several decades. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You just heard from Marty Chatsmith. She's Associate Director of the Newark Earthworks Center. If you have a question or comment about that, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. Also with us, Carrie Holton is President of the Delaware Nation. Carrie, how did you end up becoming part of the leadership of the Delaware Nation? Obviously, it's not a requirement to grow up in Oklahoma.
No, and it was actually by accident. I was very civically involved in my community in Georgia. Whenever the president of our nation passed, they had an election, and I figured that the same people would run. There was an issue that was raised about having to be geographically located close to the reservation mm-hmm. to run for office, and that wasn't in my constitution. So I challenged that, and that challenge was simply to throw my hat in the ring. They decided to change that, and I ended up on the ballot, and I ended up winning the election by one vote. I declined, actually, to serve as president because I had a business and a family in Georgia that I was returning to. But the elders convinced me to please stay. They had basically voted me in to bring a new perspective, mm-hmm. to bring something different because our tribe had really gotten into a rut governmentally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that happening more and more? When people are from away from the reservations, getting involved in the activities of the tribes?
I think it's true for my tribe. I can only really speak for the Comanche tribe, and they are very vitally involved right now. They're going through elections, so it's very, very important. Even though there is a big contingent of Comanches in Colorado, for example, uh-huh. and California, they will come home and... In fact, this weekend we're having a big fair where people from all over the world are coming who are Comanche.
Where's that fair at?
Lawton, Oklahoma.
Okay. Okay. What are the biggest challenges in preserving the culture of the Delaware Nation?
It's enormous. It's an enormous task. As Marty mentioned, we moved through 16 states. We have the longest movement of any tribe, or one of the longest. But we have historical sites throughout those 16 states. So we're trying to connect with those 16 states. I began in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and I'm slowly moving in the direction that we migrated. So that's what brings me to Ohio.
Norman in Gahanna, you're on the air. Hi, Norman.
Hi. You always have a terrific show. You know, I'm impressed with what you said at the beginning about coming from Michigan down to Ohio in lack of Native Americans. And what impressed me was this book called The Other Trail of Tears. Anybody familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Yeah, Carrie Holton says he is.
Yeah. Okay. What is your comment on that? I'm just curious.
What's the book about?
What's about removing Native Americans from Ohio?
Oh, specifically Ohio. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. Kerry Holton?
In our experience, it's been a trail of broken treaties. We signed more treaties than any other tribe. And each time that we built a community, we were relocated, moved, forced out of the area. We would just do it all over again. And it was always a constant cycle of moving. And it's just left a trail of broken treaties.
So there's lots of documentation out there. Unlike what a lot of people might understand, there's a lot of stuff written about it. But it's always written in terms of the American government, in terms of the documentation. That was my experience of it, researching it as a college student.
That's correct.
And it makes you wonder what's missing.
I think there are some new materials out there about removal from the Native point of view. But that is something that is happening. And the other point of view on this is what happened to Ohio when the tribes were removed. You know, after 1840, there were no tribes left in Ohio, and it left this vacuum. And what essentially occurred was kind of an erasing of the history of indigenous people who were here. So the graves were plundered and the earthworks were excavated down to the ground as a means to try to save them before all the construction and building of towns and village and cities destroyed them already. There wasn't a big move to preserve them. But it's important to note that when we, when all the tribes were left in 1840 and these surveys were being made of all the earthworks, mm-hmm. they were complete and whole, which means the Indian people who were here recognized them as work of their ancestors and did not destroy them at all and tried to protect them.
How big was the entire earthworks before they were mucked up over the years?
When the settlers first came, they were encountered by tens of thousands of conical burial mounds. Mm-hmm. And we're familiar what those look like because there are several around the town. But there were also 600 earthworks complexes made up of two or three or more very large Hopewell earthworks. These are geometrical earthworks and acreages of size. So the octagon earthworks has a 40-acre octagon and a 20-acre circle. There were 600 of these all over the state. And in Chillicothe, there were 12 miles of them along the river. So they couldn't have missed them. And the tribes certainly, who had lived here for generations, tried to protect them as long as they could. In fact, Marietta couldn't be made as a city after Ohio became a state because it had to be an armed camp. They kept trying to settle there, and they were ousted over and over again. And what's there? Confluence of River and Marietta Earthworks.
What what do we know about the Hopewell? They know that it's their ancestors, but they don't necessarily know what that connection is.
That's true. Most of what we know about the Hopewell come from funerary objects that were taken from the graves. And some of those graves were huge rectangular mounds, like three stories high, and about the length of a football field, though I might not quite get that number right, but and people were buried with the very best, so to help them on their journey to the afterlife. Mm-hmm. Most of what we know comes from that. And then also, as farmers started tilling the land, everyday objects and village sites started coming to the surface. So we do know what implements they used and that kind of thing. But as for the meaning and the purpose of building these places and exactly how they lived, we are putting it together. In fact, the Miamia Center is very good at helping us understand that the Miami people built their agriculture gardens on floodplains, very fertile. They built in companion planting so that one plant helped another. And then it washed away and rebuilt its nutrients in the soil. So we do have these bits and pieces coming from both the tribal research and the academic research.
But those are bits and pieces that you're putting together, because there was some gap in there where the American Indians lost touch with their past. Do we know much about what happened? Was there some kind of, I don't know, maybe some environmental thing that happened where they had to leave or and come back or anything?
You mean leave Ohio?
Yeah.
So in 1830, the Congress passed the Indian Removal Act.
Well, there's the Indian Removal Act, but I mean before that, because even before that, when settlers, when the Europeans would come here and ask about the earthworks, they didn't really understand where they came from. They just knew that was their ancestors.
Not even that sometimes.
Yeah.
I would say that they were in a protective mode, and so they maybe didn't want to give up all their information.
Yeah.
And say too much. I think that's actually, I'm a
Very
Comanche.
True.
Yeah.
I'm a Comanche, and that's kind of like a skill.
That's so interesting, Akira. You're nodding.
Yes, that's very true. Always protecting, even to today.
Well, so back in Oklahoma, where they eventually, what the survivors wound up, did they have information that helped understand, help us understand what happened?
I'm certain of it. Then they pass those stories down, but those get lost over time. And
right. It's such a mystery.
Some of the tribes that are in the northern part who were in the Ohio Valley, the Anishinaabe and the Six Nations, they kind of stayed in their place. In terms of location.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't remove long ways. So they did forays into Ohio, but they are on their ancestral lands that they'd been on for a long time. And they have a more complete record, let's say, of their tribal traditions. And some of that, of course, was disrupted, but they have a more complete kind of history for themselves. We just haven't connected up with them yet to see what they might say about Ohio.
Right. We are talking about American Indian history in Ohio, its connection to Oklahoma right now with you just heard from Marty Chatsmith. She's Associate Director of the Newark Earthwork Center, and also with us, Kerry Holton. He's President of the Delaware Nation. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In 2014, Ohio designated the last week in September as American Indian Week. For more information about the events celebrating American Indian Week, visit the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. There's still pretty interesting stuff going on the rest of this week into Saturday. We're talking about American Indian culture and the historic connection between Ohio and the Indian nations that now reside in Oklahoma. Still with us is President of the Delaware Nation of Oklahoma, Kerry Holton, and with us, Interim Director of the Newark Earthwork Center at The Ohio State University, Marty Chatsmith. And welcome back once again to both of you. Marty, you've been involved with the nomination process to get the Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks on the UNESCO's World Heritage List. Can you talk about what that means and what's the significance of that and what the progress has been?
So I'd like to direct our listeners to go to World Heritage Ohio on the internet. There's a very nice discussion and summary of where we are up to now. The World Heritage nomination is something that's global. The United States has about 25 sites that are World Heritage sites, like Everglades and Yosemite Park and Grand Canyon, and they have natural sites like Taos, New Mexico, Cahokia, and Poverty Point. And Newark Earthworks is set to become one of the next ones that will be considered for recognition.
And one of the next to be considered.
That's right. And we have a staff assigned to us from the Department of Interior,
okay,
because that's where the nomination is taken from the U.S. to UNESCO for consideration. It's a very high priority right now because so many cultural sites around the world are being destroyed through war and conflict. And so preservation and protection are extremely important. And Newark falls into that. The Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks fall into that category because urbanization is encroaching on it. And there's only two extant sites that were not ever removed, and that was the Great Circle in Newark and the Octagon Earthworks in Newark. what draws people about these places is that they're examples of genius and accomplishment. They were built by brilliant indigenous people 2,000 years ago and probably had been working on it for much longer than that. And this challenges the stereotypes and misinformation about American Indians as being primitive or backward and savage. Those things were used as a rationale to remove the tribes, even though many in the government wanted to respect the rights of indigenous people to stay. So it links us to the past and to the future, because we want our children to know the true history of American Indians in the United States, and that they were accomplished astronomers. They understood science, maybe not the way we do, but they had scientific knowledge that maintained over time. Just a quick note, the Octagon Earthworks follows the 18 and 219-day lunar cycle. How many generations is that before you figure out that there's a lunar standstill every 20 years, when we're told that the lifespan of American Indian people then were shorter? So that meant that information was maintained over time in some way. And many of these complexes look designed and planned. Enormous places lasted 2,000 years, and I recommend that anyone who hasn't been to them to go see them. What it also does is it provides a venue or a method or a way for contemporary tribes to be involved in interpretation and policies about land management related to these sites, and that has happened now. When I was first involved with the World Heritage Committee, I was the only American Indian on the committee, and now there are five or six of us. I think there's six of us on that committee, and we are consulted by the other groups in the committee subcommittees about our input, and we each represent our colleagues, scholars, tribal members back home and back in other places. So World Heritage will bring, the estimates are very high. Student travel and the tourism travel is growing. It's a growing segment of the business population, of the business sector. And World Heritage will just give added value and a big boost for that. And our goal with our group is that American Indians and tribes, tribal governments, have a big say and a big participation in that. And some of them will have opportunities to create businesses and support services for this big influx of visitors that are expected to come. And then we hope to get leaders involved at the highest level of American Indian community, and also with the larger institutions here, the government, the universities, the colleges, to help plan for this big change that's about to come when World Heritage is completed.
Kiri Holton, as president of the Delaware Nation, what's the significance of all of this to you and the people you represent?
It's always been about protection. We work very diligently, very hard to protect these areas, historic areas, everywhere we've been. Like I said, 16 states. That is an enormous task to monitor and get involved in protecting. But it's always about protection, always has been. And of course, when you start talking about turning a site into a World Heritage Site, very meaningful, because that does offer another level of protection, as well as it educates. The education will be much broader. More people will know. And so that's very important, the education aspect. And then even opportunities for business opportunities or anything related to that.
The tourism piece of this, you mean?
Tourism, yes. Yeah. That's wonderful and a great thing. We want to be able to tell our stories, and that's one of the walls that we've run up against, is trying to tell our stories from our perspective, and this will give us an opportunity to do that.
Some of the things the tribes have done to support World Heritage and Ohio's effort in this is the Newark Earthwork Center and the Eastern Shawnee Tribe co-sponsored a resolution with the National Congress of American Indians. National Congress of American Indians is the primary lobbying group on behalf of tribes.
In Washington?
In Washington. Mm-hmm. There's 567 tribes, and about 300 of them are members of that. And then last year, the Elder Council for the Pokagon Potawatomi came and visited the earthworks. John Lau is our professor, who is Pokagon Potawatomi at Newark, and they also wrote a resolution in support of World Heritage. So tribes are stepping up. They're bringing heritage trips of their tribal members to visit these places and their own ancestral places, their historic sites where their grandparents and great-grandparents lived here, great-grandparents. And so they are stepping up, and they are vitally interested in being a part of what goes forward here in cultural matters.
You don't feel so isolated anymore, huh?
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Let's take a couple calls now. Dan in Wilmington, you're on the air. Hi, Dan.
Hi there. I'm calling to ask, is there a record or anything else available to where we can track the Indian name? My daughter's been doing the ancestry thing, and she swears that I basically may be Delaware, although my family, during the process of growing up, naturally they tried to hide the fact we were Indian from people in the community, but we all knew we were. And the last name that I'm concerned about, or I would like to know if there is a list, is Abling. My great-grandfather was Mecaudjus Samuel Abling, and my grandmother, which grew up near where they met her was the Scioto River, which would have been Chillicothe. And I thought perhaps maybe they had some type of a register somewhere we could track back.
So is there like an Ancestry.com out there for American Indians?
Yes.
Yeah. Kerry Holton?
What I would suggest is there are three Delaware tribes in the United States, the Delaware Nation, the Delaware Tribe of Oklahoma, as well as the Stockbridge Muncie in Wisconsin. And we all have enrollment departments. And if there is someone that feels that they have heritage, and it might even be enough to qualify for enrollment in one of the nations, certainly you should pursue that. We welcome that, and that it is one way to discover your heritage is just simply to fill out an enrollment form. The department will do a search and determine if you are qualified or if you even have the heritage. So there's ways of doing that, and I would suggest that contact the tribes.
Okay, Dan, thanks for that question. You know, I guess the three of us probably grew up in a time, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s when people didn't want to know and ignored it and hid it, their connection to American Indian heritage. And now there has to be this huge surge, just partly people maybe like Dan, who just wants to know what his family's heritage is and do the genealogy, but also people who have rediscovered the importance of it. It's probably a pretty exciting time.
It is, and it's very large. There's a lot of people that are coming and saying, you know, we never got on the rolls. We were never on the Dawes rolls or even identified as Native American. My mm-hmm. ancestors just – they had to. It was for survival. You almost had to
reject
disregard
your past,
it and,
yeah.
Yeah, and try to blend in. So these folks are discovering their roots, and they want to know. And I certainly – applaud that. You should know. Everybody should know their genealogy and where they came from.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call. Sandy in Logan County, you're on the air. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Ann. Yeah, this is wonderful. I love it. It's something I've wanted to know for years. I live basically in the center of the Shawnee Nation. This is in Logan County near West Liberty. And even as a child, I wanted to know, you know, just where have they gone, you know. I even named my daughter, her middle name is Macochee, which is this one of the septs of the Shawnee Nation, meaning Smiling Valley. I just wanted to know if anything embedded within the Shawnee language, or how much different is the Shawnee language, say, from the Wyandot language? Where are these people in Oklahoma? And can I talk to them? And can I even learn anything about the language that shows me something about the beautiful land I live in that was once theirs?
Yeah, there certainly is tribes, and they welcome people to learn more. The Shawnees, just like the Delaware, experienced a diaspora. They split into different bands, different tribes, went in different directions. But there's three of them in Oklahoma: the Eastern Shawnee, the Absentee Shawnee, and the Shawnee. And they're located in different areas of the state, and all have thriving governments and thriving economies. And I'd certainly suggest that you learn more.
What's the Absentee Shawnee?
Absentee Shawnee, we are the Absentee Delaware originally. Okay. Before we were before we renamed ourselves as the Delaware Nation. We were absent from one of the last treaties. Absent from that process, we didn't receive the lands or any of the benefits that came from that treaty, and we were just declared as the absentee and afforded other benefits. And
okay, it was sort of a legal term then.
Correct.
Gotcha, Sandy. Thank you so much for that call. And Jesse in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. I just want to say, first of all, I love this show. This show is awesome.
Thank you.
But what I wanted to call and actually ask about is what your guys' thoughts were in regards to what's going on with everything about the Dakota Access Pipeline, because to be frankly honest, I don't really see that reported as much as I would really like to.
I'm happy to speak to that. Again, let me just say it's about protection. And I was in D.C. just earlier this week, and this issue is an enormous issue across Indian country. The tribes are coming together, supportive of the Standing Rock Sioux, to cease this destruction of what they feel like is historical sites, and just to put in a pipeline. The tribes are gathering in South Dakota, Camp Dakota. There's thousands, from what I understand, and it continues to grow and thrive. And one of the things I would say, anytime you do hear the news, they refer to them as protesters. That's not what they are. They're protectors. And it's interesting to see the youth that are involved in this. The tribal youth really are the ones that somewhat spearheaded this and said, hey, we don't want to see this happen to our ancestral lands. Our history is being destroyed, and that's exactly what the World Heritage is trying to do, is to offer more protection.
And the significance now over this pipeline is that Indian nations are coming together, because it's sort of a slippery slope. If this pipeline goes in, then it's sending a message about other lands in other places.
It's impactful on our sovereignty, on our abilities to protect other lands and other sites. There is a process to this. It's called Section 106. We do it every day, hundreds of times a week, to determine these historical sites and if there's anything that needs to be protected. And that's exactly what was going on there. The fault is, and what it appears to be, is there was a failure to communicate, a failure to consult with the tribes, a government-to-government consultation that should have taken place. And that's what it really comes down
to.
That's the big issue.
And their planning moved forward to a certain extent, and now it looks like a protest because they were never consulted in the first place.
That's correct.
Gotcha. All right, Jesse, thanks a lot for that call, and thank you so much for listening. Archaeology Day at the Ohio History Center is set for October 1st, and I was wondering, what should people be looking for as they examine artifacts from the past? Marty Chatsmith, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you, can you give us a little bit of a legend about what to look for?
I'm not an archaeologist, but I do know that a lot of very beautiful pieces are in private collections. It's not illegal to buy or sell ancient artifacts. So sometimes the only time we see some of these amazing artifacts are in these exchanges and archaeology days. Mm-hmm. I think the archaeologists do a good job of explaining what they are, and also giving the people guidelines about digging things up and what you're supposed to do with them. Once something's out of the ground, archaeology can't figure out anything about it, really, just beyond the general. So I think it's a good program, and I think people should listen to the archaeologists and what they have to say.
Well, Marty Chatsmith, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about it. Marty Chatsmith is Associate Director of the Newark Earthworks Center. Also, Kerry Holton, President of the Delaware Nation. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Waneshi.
And thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, the All Sides interns, Walter Hopp, Jessica Shakespeare, and Shelby Powers. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.